the whole world economy is contracting. In some places, it's pretty, they're having very real problems. Well, to help us analyze what's going on and begin to look in the future, James, you go right ahead.
Well, thank you, as always, for having me on. It's great to be here, and there's a lot going on in the world, and even though this is the summer doldrums, it should generally be that time of year where not much is happening, this being the topsy-turvy, bizarro economic world that we've talked about here on the program before, there is still things happening here in the summer that are of note, and I think one of them that just happened in the past couple of weeks that's worth looking at is the accession of Mark Carney to the governorship of the Bank of England, which took place on the 1st of July, and has already generated some headlines and some press, especially for his presiding over the first monthly Monetary Policy Committee meeting, which decides, basically like the Federal Open Market Committee in the United States, decides on interest rates going forward. And that was scrutinized quite closely by the British financial press after he presided over his first meeting, at which they decided not to raise interest rates. And in fact, the forward guidance says that the Bank of England will not be raising rates anytime soon as CPI starts kicking upwards and, in fact, creeping up over 3% now, so hitting its highest rate in over a year. So Mark Carney has his work cut out for him, I suppose, but I think it would be interesting to take a look at some of his past and his career as some guidance as to what type of Bank of England governor he'll be. And it's important for people out there to note that, of course, just like so many other banksters and so many other technocrats who have been parachuted into various positions of power over the past few years have been, Mark Carney is also a former Goldman Sachs executive. He spent 13 years at Goldman Sachs and worked his way up to managing director after having worked in New York and Tokyo and Toronto. And surprise, surprise, now he finds himself not only in position of power at the Bank of Canada and not only at the Bank of England, but also at the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, the central bank of central banks. So Mark Carney is definitely someone who's been making the rounds and has been a good globalist bankster for the powers that shouldn't be. So it will be very interesting to see what his tenure at the Bank of England actually ends up doing for the British economy.
Well, I think that most people honestly believe that Bank of England has something to do with the British government, just as they believe that the Federal Reserve System has to do with the United States federal government, and they don't understand these are privately owned central banks. Their goal is certainly not, of course, to stabilize the English, the American economy, but to enrich the bankers and certainly to centralize power in the hands of a small ruling elite, that small ruling elite that truly rules the world. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. I guess this afternoon is James Corbett. We're talking about what's going on financially throughout the world. And unfortunately, most people already are under the misguided assumption that when we talk about the Federal Reserve System here in the United States, we're talking about something that has to do with the federal government. After all, the Federal Reserve System, the central bank, certainly is a branch of the American government. And the truth of the matter is not. It's not that the government controls the central bank. It's that the central bank controls the government, and they basically control the wealth of the United States. They control the economy, and they can either stimulate the economy by keeping interest rates low, by certainly, and by pouring money into the economy. And the only trouble is eventually they end up destroying the value of the currency. But in the meantime, they can enrich themselves and their elite. It's only certainly when the whole thing falls apart that the average individual is impoverished. And it's happened time and time again down through the ages, going back to the origin of the central bank in England back in the late 1690s. But basically, there's certainly a new leader of the Bank of England there. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about him?
That's right. Well, once again, his name is Mark Carney. He's a Canadian, and he was the former Bank of Canada governor who has now been parachuted in to take over the Bank of England governorship in an unusual move. It's unusual for a Canadian to be recruited in to take the reins of the Bank of England. And it's also unusual. He's now one of the top paid public servants in all of the UK. He's now on an £825,000, I believe, salary. So something equivalent to about over $1 million a year for his salary. Plus, of course, all the benefits, perks, pension, and otherwise that he receives. So quite handsomely remunerated for his position. And it's important to note that not only has he been a Goldman Sachs executive, not only has he worked for the Bank of Canada, not only is he now governor of Bank of England, but he also sits as the chair of the Financial Stability Board, which is something that's been created by the G7 back in 1999, I believe it was first created. And it continues to function as a global body that's meant to set global financial and banking regulations as a way of bringing stability to the global financial system. And if all of that seems a lot of globals for you, it's because, of course, Mark Carney is a globalist and has proven himself well for his globalist masters in the past. So he comes with a fair degree of pedigree for the Bank of England. But it's important to note that the financial...
Hold that thought, James. We'll be back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and James is simply talking about the new president of the Bank of England. And who is he? Well, he's a Canadian. But of course, he comes from Goldman Sachs. You must understand, ladies and gentlemen, there are six major banks that control the economy of the world, or at least six major American banks. They have a couple of branches of Sydney over in Europe as well, and they all work together. Basically, this is a system by which a very small number of people controls the economies and certainly is able to create wealth by simply printing paper money. And as long as people are foolish enough to accept it, why, the system works very well. And eventually they collapse the system, as they have repeatedly down through the ages, and the people are impoverished, and then we start in all over again. And you hear Sidney, the new president of the Bank of England, this Canadian, making over $1 million a year, well over $1 million a year. And basically these people sometimes certainly will make $30-40 million a year. In fact, we had a gentleman who became the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board during the previous administration, but he was making $30 million a year when he was president, I believe, of Goldman Sachs or Citicorp. I can't remember which of the banks it was, but this is how the system works. You have a small elite. And these people are globalists. Their loyalty is not certainly to individual countries, but to this globalist dream of a one-world government under a ruling elite. And that's what it's really all about. And one of these days, of course, the whole economic system is coming down. Why? Because the only thing that's keeping America going today is the fact that the Federal Reserve Board is printing or creating out of nothing $85 billion a month, and simply putting part of that into mortgage bonds to basically bail out the banks, and the other part into treasury bonds so that the treasury will be able to pay its bills. Basically, the treasury, of course, is running a massive deficit. It doesn't have the money to put out the checks for Medicare and food stamps and Social Security. So the Federal Reserve simply buys up bonds so they will have money. And the system is working fine for the time being, but eventually the day of reckoning is coming. You can't create money out of nothing indefinitely before the whole thing comes cascading down. James, you pick up the story.
Well, you're exactly right to point out Goldman Sachs' role in this, and certainly they've been known as Government Sachs in recent years because of just how much former Goldman Sachs executives have infested the upper echelons of the United States Treasury, for example, and of course previous Treasury secretaries like Hank Paulson, who oversaw the original bailout plan during the Lehman Brothers collapse, was himself, of course, the former chief executive of Goldman Sachs. So again, that is. Well-established in the United States. It's also well-established in Europe now, where not only Mario Draghi, the head of the European Central Bank, but also Mario Monti, who was parachuted in to take over the presidency of Italy undemocratically a couple of years ago and was recently voted out by the Italian people in their first opportunity to do so. He was also Goldman Sachs. So Goldman Sachs has their finger in just about every pie these days, and here we are now with the new Bank of England governor, Mark Carney, also a former Goldman Sachs managing director. So again, just another tentacle of the vampire squid, as Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone has memorably called Goldman Sachs. But it's also important, as I was saying, to note that Bart Carney also sits as the chair of the Financial Stability Board, which is an international, global financial and banking regulation policy board that tries to set these global regulations in an effort to bring stability to the global financial system. And the Financial Stability Board is interesting for a number of reasons, but one of them is because this board has been putting together and trying to institutionalize something like the Cyprus bail-in regime for a few years now. This has been discussed and has been included in various reports. And it's interesting to note that just last year, earlier this year, Canada's new budget came out. The government of Canada came out with their new budget, which included a provision basically talking about a bail-in regime in Canada, or at least the possibility for some type of bail-in. And for people who don't remember, that was like what we saw in Cyprus, where one day you have, say, 100,000 euro in your bank account, and the next you have 50,000 or 20,000. Or whatever they let you keep as they take the rest of the money to bail in to the bank if the bank goes insolvent. This would obviously cause a lot of furor in Cyprus and a lot of jitters in Europe, generally speaking, because people thought of this might be the new kind of regime in the event of bank collapses. And Canada has already made moves towards institutionalizing that there. Of course, that was when Mark Carney was governor of Bank of Canada. Now he's moving over to Bank of England. So I think he might be just bringing along his Financial Stability Board globalist financial regulation policies with him. And I think the people of the United Kingdom should probably look out for that. And of course, people around the world should be concerned about that, because what happens at the Bank of England is obviously going to have knock-on effects on the global economy. So this is definitely a globalist insider who's taking over the reins there in the old lady of Threadneedle Street. And I think people should be keeping their eye on what he ends up doing during his time as governor.
And ladies and gentlemen, there's just a very, very small number of people that really run the world. So James was just talking about the fellow who was the Prime Minister of Italy. He wasn't elected by the people. His name is Mario Monti. He was appointed. Who appointed him? Well, he was just appointed. Of course, as soon as the people got a chance, they voted him out. But who is Mario Monti? Why, of course, he said he's come from the banking industry, but he was a member of the Trilateral Commission. He was a member of the European chapter. And if you have any question what we're talking about, go up on the Internet and look up trilateral.org. Trilateral.org, and so you can go to their website, look at their logo, and basically it's three, it's in a circle, it's three curved arrows, and if you look very carefully and you understand that they are three sixes, look at the inside, you'll see the three sixes bound together by an upside down broken cross. These people understand the spiritual implications of what's going on. It's just that the average individual can't, because they look at the thing from a financial and a political and ideological battle point of view. They don't look at it from a spiritual point of view. But the people on the other side understand the significance of 666. It's simply that the average American doesn't. Three sixes bound together by an upside-down broken cross. Look at their logo, ladies and gentlemen. Look at their logo and understand. Our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. Our guest is James Corbett. But James, you go right ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I just wanted to. You'd mentioned Mario Monti, and most people have never understood where he came from or the significance of their logo. They understand, it's just that the average individual doesn't. Go ahead.
Well, you're exactly right, and we do see the 666 encoded into so many corporate logos, and I don't think that is coincidental, and you can even look at certain things like the S&P hitting its low at 666, and other instances of that popping up in financial circles. So I think that it's quite obvious who are the insiders and what their when their calling card when they're tinkering with the system. And that's just another aspect of what's going on generally. Unfortunately, things continue to spiral out of control in a lot of different ways, and one of the interesting ones that's popped up in recent weeks has been the crisis in China. There's been a credit crisis there that took over in June and really started to have some major knock-on effects on the Chinese economy. In fact, people were even having trouble withdrawing their funds from Chinese banks for a few days there. The banks assured people that this was not related to the credit crunch, but I don't know if anyone took those reassurances seriously. And the latest sign that there might be problems with the Chinese banking sector, and more importantly, the shadow banking sector, which now, according to estimates, accounts for about $6 trillion of wealth, is this a new scheme that they're coming out with called wealth management products that banks are selling as a way of trying to bring some financial stability to people who are worried about this credit crunch and what it might mean for their future savings and income. So they're offering these wealth management products that are offering sizable returns. And unfortunately, it looks like that these wealth management products are really just another Ponzi scheme that isn't really being held up by anything except for the Chinese government's basically promise to step in and to bring down property speculation and bolster the stock market by injecting liquidity into the system, which caused the credit crisis in the first place. But now they're basically betting on the Chinese government continuing to do that, and because of that, they're rolling that into these wealth management products that people are snapping up and buying in great numbers. But it looks like this might be causing cracks and stresses on the system. And if this were ever to dry up, if the Chinese government, for example, were to turn off the spigot of easy central bank credit, this could affect these wealth management products and end up having huge knock-on effects in the economy. So China is really there's a lot of cracks under the facade of China that people aren't necessarily seeing on the surface. But they certainly do represent some very serious threats to the Chinese economy, which once again, in this globally connected age, does have knock-on effects for people all around the world. And we've already seen that in recent months and recent years as the Chinese economic dragon has cooled off definitely in recent years. And I think even the fudged numbers and statistics coming out of the Bank of China, the Chinese central bank, can't smooth or wallpaper over the real cracks in the facade that are beginning to show. So again, just another sign that the global economy is A, extremely interconnected, and B, extremely fragile, so that now it's not just true that when the American markets sneeze, the entire world catches a cold, but now it's even the Chinese banking sector. If that were to sneeze, I think the entire world might catch that cold. So it's all part, of course, of the long-term game plan of getting the entire global economy completely interconnected and dependent on each other, so that if there is a crisis, it will affect the pretty much the entire world. And that's,
yeah, I think it's going to. Our telephone number is 1-888. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. Basically, ladies and gentlemen, we're heading into very difficult financial times. Most Americans think that somehow things are going to get better, but, well, we're just going to have to wait and see, but I'm not optimistic. Be back in a moment. James, you go right ahead.
Well, unfortunately, again, there's not a lot of rosy spots on the economic horizon at this point in time, but we have seen a sort of miniature rally in gold over the last several days. And in fact, we're heading up towards the $1,300 level, which is a psychological resistance ceiling, according to the traders, which means that if it does break past 1,300, there is a chance that we might see another leg upwards. So again, that's something to keep people's eyes on. But again, there's not going to be a whole lot of movement, I think, happening during the summer doldrums. I think we're going to start seeing the big action happening when everything convenes again back in September, of course, most notably with the Federal Open Market Committee's meeting, which will see at least potentially, the beginning of the big vaunted ballyhooed taper of quantitative easing, or at the very least, probably some forward guidance that will give us some more indication of whether or not the Federal Reserve will taper quantitative easing. Personally, I think there might be some lip service towards that, and I think that they might attempt to do that overtly, but I think there's going to be another round of either another round of quantitative easing or some other way of injecting the money into the economy, whether that be something like Operation Twist, which they used before. But I don't think they're going to be able to really remove the supports from the economy at this point. And I think that what happened in the markets after they suggested that after the last Federal Open Market Committee meeting pretty much shows that the markets simply aren't ready for the Fed to stop injecting this $85 billion of funny money into the economy every month.
But it's my understanding that some members of the Federal Reserve Board, some of the people, members there, are really very, very concerned that we can't keep doing this. There seems to be a growing awareness that one of these days we're going to have to consider stopping just putting out all this money. You can't continue creating money out of nothing indefinitely, can you?
You certainly can't, but I'm not sure I would trust the individual opinions of some of the Federal Open Market Committee members. I think that there's definitely a political motivation and calculus to their pronouncements, and we see, for example, when the markets all started plunging after after Ben Bernanke's last press conference where he hinted at the tapering, and we saw pretty much every major Fed official come out in the days following to give interviews to say, no, we're not going to taper. You're overreacting. Don't worry. And we saw the markets calm down after that. So certainly when there's a message to be conveyed, they will all get on board and sing the same tune. So I think that I take what they say or what's reported about what they say with a grain of salt. There is some difference of opinion on the board, but generally speaking, they're all going to fall in line with whatever the prevailing ideology of the day is. And of course, it's all meant to try to, again, massage the markets, whether it needs some stability or whether it needs to go up or whether they even want to reduce expectation and bring it down. They'll just say whatever needs to be said in that regard. So I take their pronouncements with a grain of salt.
Well, you know, one of the things that's really so puzzling is we hear that a lot of the corporations are not doing very well, but apparently they're sitting on large sums of money. Have you heard this? And why would they be sitting on these large sums of money? Why isn't this being invested or certainly returned to the stockholders?
Well, you look at a company like Apple, which is the largest company in the world, at least according to share's stock valuation, and yes, they're sitting on a huge pile of cash.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is James Corbett, and certainly we're talking about what's really happening. And what a lot of people don't understand, that many of our major corporations, they certainly are not making a great deal of money, but they have massive amounts of cash on hand. It's certainly a lot of it's being kept overseas, because if they bring it back to the United States, they'd have to pay income tax on it. Surely keeping it certainly overseas. But certainly, James was talking about, for instance, Apple, the most prosperous company in the world, and simply go ahead and develop your ideas as far as Apple. They're sitting on massive cash reserves, aren't they?
They are. In fact, they've now reached $145 billion of cash, which is just a mind-boggling figure. But only $45 billion of that is in the U.S. So exactly as you say, they don't want to repatriate that for tax purposes, because that would mean they'd have to pay tax on it in the United States. So they've got $100 billion out there that they can't actually really use in any way in their U.S. Operations without suffering the tax consequences. So they're in the bizarre position of even continuing to offer bonds as a way of financing debt when they have $145 billion of cash lying around. So it's a pretty bizarre situation. And they're not the only ones, but I think they are probably the number one example of that type of situation in a corporate office. So it is quite bizarre to take a look at that stockpile of cash that they have sitting around. and wondering what they can do about it. It's funny to think of, but they actually do have a cash flow problem, precisely because they're not able to move that money around without inflicting tax penalties, which they're not prepared to take.
All right, fine. Well, Sydney, basically, of course, are a lot of major corporations in this situation. In other words, they have massive amounts of money overseas. And where is that? Is that being held in banks overseas? Are they getting interest on that money? What's happening to it? Do we have any idea?
I don't know specifically, but my understanding would be that it is probably being held in foreign banks and is probably earning interest. So I think that there's the incentive not really to touch it at this time, because at the very least, it could be that kind of rainy day fund if they ever really had some sort of real crunch happening in the United States, then they would be able to repatriate it and take the tax hit if necessary. So I think it is kind of just the war chest that they're amassing at the moment, and they're happy to leave it in the foreign banks for the moment, because again, it is earning them interest just sitting around doing nothing.
But of course, if the money was here, it could be invested in plants, it could be invested in production, it could produce jobs in America, but it's not being used to produce jobs in America. It's just sitting idly in banks overseas, and a lot of those banks aren't investing it either, are they?
No, of course not. No, the money is not circulating in the American economy very much at all. So that is another huge part of this process. Again, money can be created until the cows come home, but if it's not circulating in the economy, then it's not going to have an effect on that economy fundamentally, except maybe to downplay market jitters or something of that sort. So that's what I think we're seeing fundamentally with the current round of quantitative easing with the Fed, buying mortgage-backed securities to help fund the growing next round of the American housing bubble, and buying long-term treasuries to keep yields down, which we saw again in the wake of the taper pronouncement last month. We saw the yields start to rise. The yield curve just spiked by a huge amount. So I think they were quite worried about losing control of interest rates and yields. And so we saw them try to talk that down. But again, this is the effects that they're having on the economy right now. And it's quite worrying to anyone who understands what's happening, just the amount of control that the central banksters have over the economy right now and how much they are dictating what's happening. Again, even people who aren't directly in the markets or invested in the markets, still your business or your economic activity does rely on what's happening in those markets and what the effect they have in the overall economy. So unfortunately, this is the type of thing that ties everyone together, so that the pronouncements of the Fed and the movements of the markets really do have a knock-on effect on everyone, even down on Main Street. And unfortunately, even as Main Street stagnates, and even as banksters keep getting record bonuses year after year, I think that we see the idea of the economy detach further and further from the actual productive economy itself. So that now when they talk about the GDP, et cetera, I think they're not really talking about what's happening in the real economy. They're just talking about financial services and the like, which, again, is just kind of airy, very abstract figures.
Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Our guest is James Corbett. If you have a question or comment, I think it's important that you understand that we go from bubble to bubble to bubble. Everything is being manipulated. We do not have a free enterprise system. We have a manipulated enterprise system. And when those house of cards come down, heaven help us all. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, our guest is James Corbett. And James, you were talking about the bubbles. And certainly, we go from bubble to bubble to bubble. Do you see another bubble coming up here in the not-too-distant future?
Well, not only do I see them in the future, I think that we're living in the times of expanding bubbles at the moment. And I think you're exactly right. I think the last couple of decades specifically has been defined by just bubble after bubble. And unfortunately, one leads to another leads to another. So we saw the rise of the dot-com bubble there in the late 90s. And when that popped, we saw Alan Greenspan come in to basically inflate the housing bubble by dropping rates to all-time lows and keeping them there for year after year. And when the housing bubble became too big and ended up bursting, I think what we saw was just basically the creation of a new bubble, the bond bubble, which is just this injection of money into bonds that we've seen, for example, with the quantitative easing from the Federal Reserve. So we've seen bubble after bubble for a long time now, and I think we are in the midst of a bond bubble right now, which is, as one of the Bank of England officials said, the largest bond bubble in history, and it's been purposefully inflated by the central banksters. And when that starts, when the air starts to come out of that bubble, I think they're hoping that it will be a gradual, slow, nice, orderly takedown. But
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Greg is simply talking about all the bubbles we've had, and certainly we've had the dot-com bubble and the housing bubble, and right now there's a bond bubble. And James is concerned that if this thing should really begin to fall apart, that it could have a disastrous effect. Certainly the bond market is much, much larger than the stock market. People really don't understand. And of course the price of bonds is up because interest rates are down. But when interest rates start to go up, why the price of bonds is going to begin to crumble. And when that happens, you're talking basically pension funds are invested in that. Annuities are invested into bonds. Our major banks are hedge funds. Everybody's invested in bonds. This is certainly the basis of our whole monetary and capitalist system. Money invested in bonds, a massive bond market. And of course, it's James' contention. This isn't a bubble at the present time. Would you like to develop that idea for our listeners?
Absolutely. Well, you're exactly right. Bonds are traditionally part of, for example, retirement or pension portfolios because they have been stable. And for the majority of baby boomers' adult lives, bonds have been rising in value. They've been in a 30 plus year cycle now of rising values. But I think we're going to see bonds suddenly are going to start tracking downwards, and that's the only way for them to go right now. I mean, they're propped up as much as they can be by the Federal Reserve, and so even if the Federal Reserve just begins to taper back a little bit, I think it's going to have a big effect on the bond bubble. And again, they're going to try to bring this down in a nice orderly fashion, but bubbles have a funny way of bursting rather than just deflating. So that's one thing that I see on the horizon. I also wrote about some other bubbles that are forming in the most recent International Forecaster, where I wrote, for example, about the higher education bubble, where we see student loan debt at all-time highs and only continuing to grow. In fact, student loan debt is far outstripping credit card debt in terms of just the sheer amount of it that's there in the United States. In fact, it's now over $1 trillion in student loan debt out there, which is a staggering figure, and especially when one considers that in this day and age, the return on investment for a four-year college degree, especially a six-figure pricey four-year college degree, is just dwindling further and further, so that students are coming out of these programs just saddled in debt and more and more finding it difficult to find jobs that are that pay anything much more than minimum wage, which is just an untenable and unsustainable situation. And I think there's going to come a point in the near future where parents and students alike start to realize that the return on investment on in this is just not worth the investment. Especially, even the Bureau of Labor Statistics estimates that in the next decade, 7 out of 10 fastest growing jobs are going to be based on the job training, not on higher education. So I think the word is getting out there that unless you are in a very specific or technical program in college, it is probably not worth your time to get a degree in liberal arts or something of that nature at this time, especially just given the rising tuition rates, rising student loan debts, and the falling earnings. And people can look at the charts and see that the earnings are decreasing even as the tuitions are increasing. And something has to give in that bubble at some point. So I think that people are going to wake up and realize the emperor wears no clothes when it comes to the student loan higher education scam, really, that's being played on the American people right now.
came into that. Well, let's go to Greg, who's calling us from Iowa. Again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-2295. Hi, Greg, do you have a question or comment for our guest?
I got a comment, Dr. Stan.
Okay, go ahead.
I can only speak with authority for the one society that I've lived in. Any of them that came before or are coming after me, I have no authority to talk about. But I have experienced in my life this society we're in. And this society we are in, the public must understand, is a manipulative society that misinforms the people so that they don't really know what is going on. And I think people must start checking out what they hear for information. Instead of believing information, they should listen to it, take it as a guideline, and then go out and ask questions and find out if it's true. I'll give you an example. I have gone to numerous banks in my local community here and asked questions on how they function with the Federal Reserve System. And essentially, the answer is that any money that is not loaned locally here at the bank every night is reported back to the Federal Reserve, who, in essence, borrows it overnight and pays interest on that money. Now, that money is the money that is being used to buy up the federal treasury bonds so the Congress can go further in debt. And that means that the Congress owes the people that are depositors at the bank the money. That's where Mr. Bernanke is getting his money. And if you can, anybody with a little knowledge about finance and business would understand that money that's not loaned out at the local level is and taken out of your local community makes a local economy shrink. And this is exactly what you guys are talking about, that local economies are not being stimulated. The Federal Reserve knows that, but they need people to be misinformed in order to get away with it. And that's why I'm on your telephone right now.
All right, Greg, and I think you're absolutely right. Would you like to comment on what Greg is saying, James? Because I think he's absolutely right. Basically, of course, what they're doing is just using our money to keep this whole thing going. But basically, you try to get your money out of the bank. Enough people can want to take their money out of the bank. The money ain't there. Go ahead. What are your thoughts, James?
Well, I agree completely as well. And I think that the objective of this misinformation is to get people concentrated on essentially meaningless figures like, for example, the S&P. Is it going to breach 1,600? Is it going to breach 1,700? Oh, let's all watch in anticipation. When in fact, of course, numbers like that are more and more meaningless in people's actual lives as those numbers detach more and more from economic reality. So I think the game really is to get people concentrated on what's happening federally and what's happening in the stock markets and other places like that, rather than what's happening in their own local levels. So I think it is important for people to ignore that type of misinformation and to be looking at what's happening to them directly.
Okay, fine. So anything else you want to say, Greg, before we let you go?
Well, I would say I'm impressed to anyone that's here listening. Do go ask your bank, because they are using your money, and is your money at risk that if the Federal Reserve doesn't pay back, you will be out at the bank? And if you want an example of that, go look into the Cyprus situation. That was money loaned to the Greek government, and the Greek government didn't pay it back. Instead of saying you're out of your money, they said it was a tax. That was a further misinformation. They actually lost the money that they had from the depositors, and they had to figure out a way to take and say it's gone.
And basically what happened was that the banks, the Cyprus bank started buying certain bonds from some of the other countries, and those bonds were never repatriated. They couldn't pay them back, and that's what happened. God bless you, Greg. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Point well made. Let's first go to now Aromas Rich, who's calling. Hi, Rich. How are you doing?
Hi, Grandpa Liberty. Hi, Mr. Corbin. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good. Thank you.
That's great. Mr. Corbin, I have two quick questions. Number one, I've been watching some documentary, DVDs from Walmart about Adolf Hitler from the 1920s, and I'll make it quick, but he was extracting all the people's teeth that were in the concentration camp for the gold. Well, if his paper was so worth so much, why was he extracting all that gold out?
well, if paper wasn't worth anything, it's this is the thing. Paper really certainly has no value at all, other than as long as people think it has value, fine. When they suddenly realize, of course, it has no value, then the whole system comes down. Do you have any thoughts on that, James?
I think you said it well. I think that there's, of course, the impression that that Hitler and the Nazis got Germany out of the Weimar hyperinflation and that problem. But really, I think people should take a look at the way that the Nazis were funded into existence by Wall Street. And of course, Anthony Sutton did the groundwork on that in his Wall Street and the rise of Hitler. I believe I can't
yes,
remember.
Yes, we carry that book, Wall Street. The rise of Hitler is very important for people to understand that we financed Adolf Hitler. And we carry another book called, America's Nazi Secret, I think it is. America's Nazi Secret. Anyway, John Loftus's book, calling it then certainly Dr. Cuddy's latest book, certainly on the power elite and the secret Nazi plan. Basically, we financed the Nazis. You needed an enemy, and we got one, and we financed it not only before the war, but during the war when they were actually building the weapons. General Motors and Ford Motor Company and General Electric and IBM and AT&T were all over there building the weapons so we could have a wonderful, wonderful war. Just like today, we're financing the terrorists over there. Why are we financing Al-Qaeda in Syria? Nobody wants to ask the question. Anything else, Rich, before we let you go?
Well, they don't mention that part on the DVDs. Number two is, if the market is really high right now, I think it's at 15,000 with Dow Jones, and it starts to fall and collapse, won't that bring the metals down also because people want to be covering their shorts, literally?
Right. Yes. No. I see what you're saying. So people will be taking that money out and putting it into to try to cover what the margin calls, etc. That's a possibility. But I think during times of panic, I think we see the flight to stability. So we would expect, all things being equal, we would expect the value of precious metals and even bonds to go up in a situation like that, because that's generally where people put their money during times of panic. But I see what you're saying. I think that there would be a cash liquidity crisis because people would be trying to cover margin calls and the like. So there's that aspect to it. But whether people would be selling gold to do that or not, I don't know if that would have a significant effect on the price.
I don't think they'd be selling the physical. It's all that worthless paper.
Right.
That,
yeah.
So I think they'd be selling that. But pull the market back, and then it'd be a good time to get in.
But Romish, let me just make one point.
Sure.
Nobody should be in the market on margin. You should never be in the market on margin. If you go into the market on margin, it turns against you. They will take your home. They'll take your shirt. They'll take your wife and your children. Never speculate. Never put a dollar into the bank or into an investment that you can't afford to lose. But never try you start to play the market, they're going to get you. Anything else before we let you go?
Well, no, I think the bottom line is if you want physical safety is food and the metals, because as I'm watching these movies, you see a lot of the peasant people, they're bartering, and they have either gold or silver. A lot of the Jewish people that they were bartering, and then they were being prosecuted, so they were trying to get out of the country, and they didn't take the paper. They had metal. The ones that had metal seemed to get out. But that's my observation, and I can loan you these DVDs, Grandpa, if you'd like to see them.
Okay, well, no, we don't have time, but I appreciate the offer. Thanks very much, and let's before we go on at this point, James, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you, how they can get subscribed to the International Forecaster, how they can get your publications. And then we'll get to Joseph calling from Georgia and Sarah calling from wherever Sarah's calling from. Go ahead.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for that opportunity. Yes, if people are interested in the International Forecaster, it's a newsletter on matters financial and social and geopolitical and everything in between that comes out twice a week. It's about 40 pages each edition, and it contains not only my editorial, but also articles from a number of different sources and market information. So a lot of information crammed into each issue. People can get a copy at theinternationalforecaster.com. You can go to theinternationalforecaster.com either to browse through some of my articles, or you can also just request an introductory copy if it's your first time, or you can subscribe outright there at the website. If you would prefer snail mail, you can write into P.O. Box 7752, Winter Haven, Florida, 33883. That's P.O. Box 7752, Winter Haven, Florida, 33883. And if people are interested in my own work, I'm at CorbettReport.com, CorbettReport.com, and I have thousands of hours of media there, completely freely available for download. If people do want to support my work, they can either purchase a DVD or sign up for my own subscriber newsletter, which comes out once a week.
Okay, let's go to Joseph, who's calling us from Georgia. Hi, Joseph. How are we doing?
Pretty good. About yourself?
No complaints at all. Do you have a question or comment for our guest?
Yeah, just like, I heard somebody say, some time back, like you never see any currency dated past 2009. Well, they've changed the colors on the bills to make counterfeiting harder. You know, and I've seen the 20s and stuff, but I've sold some assets over the past couple of years since then. And you see on TV where they're running the printing presses, and you see these new $100 bills, but you never get one when you go to the bank that you want to get some hundreds to put up around the house to hide some money in case of emergency or something, the internet goes down. That all I can think of is all that money, these new $100 bills they're printing, they're sitting on them somewhere, but it's not going into circulation, just like they say to all the billions they're printing up and then going into the stock market or something through the banks. But you never see one of those the latest $100 bills in circulation. So that means they're sitting on all that money they're printed up, it would seem like.
I don't really know anything at all about that. Do you, James?
I have heard this online, people talking about this, no cash in circulation after 2009, but again, I think you're right, the only new bills that I know of are the new $100 bills, and I don't know if they're circulating or not, but I imagine they might be sitting on them. But even if they are, the actual cash that is created is different. The actual bills and coins that are created is different than the funny money they're creating at the Federal Reserve, which truly is just bits and bytes in computer screens. So actual physical cash not entering the economy isn't a bad thing at any rate, because, of course, if it's not circulating, it can't contribute to inflation. So
I think that's probably very right. Yes, the best thing we can do is not have all that money in circulation. But thanks so much for calling. Let's go to Sarah, who's calling us from the great state of Washington. Sarah, do you have a question or comment for our guest?
Yes, I do. Two or three. First of all, could you give some guidelines on purchasing of gold and silver, like what percentage of each, how much silver, how much gold would you recommend? And is Lindsay Williams correct in saying that it should be a U.S. minted coin? If that makes a difference,
those are good questions. I don't have guidelines, and I don't think I would issue them in a blanket way, because I think everybody's situation is unique, and I obviously I'm not an investment advisor, so I think people have to figure that out for themselves, what their the best allocation of their resources is. But I would say that diversification is important, so I wouldn't keep it all in gold and silver. Obviously, you need other asset classes as well. In terms of buying American minted coins rather than foreign minted coins, I'm not sure I about that. Being a Canadian in Japan, I think I have a broader international perspective on that, but it certainly American minted coins would be easier to trade in the event of some type of collapse, so that might be one factor you might think about.
Okay. Well, what other assets do you recommend?
I recommend a wide range, so we'll talk about that on the other side.
Hold the thought for a moment.
Okay.
James, why don't you go right ahead? You were saying suddenly suggest a wide range of assets. What were you thinking of?
Well, I think that people should definitely have real estate, actual physical land. I think that that's important, because, again, that's something that has intrinsic value. And even in the event of some kind of collapse, the value of land is, I mean, it might go up or down in terms of the paper dollar funny money, but in terms of actual utility, land is going to be important. Other than real estate and precious metals, I think that people should have a little bit in some different classes, different commodities, when we're talking about commodities, I mean things like if people are invested in futures, then they should be in a wide variety of them. Actually, even the stock market, I don't obviously recommend the stock market often, and I don't stress it a lot. But even in times of great inflation, counterintuitively, the stock market generally tends to do well. In fact, even during the Weimar hyperinflation time in Germany, the value of the stock market at the end was actually greater than it was at the beginning, in measured in constant terms. So even stocks can maintain value. I wrote about this recently in the Forecaster because there are different collapse scenarios, and in each of them, different classes do differently in those different scenarios. So again, it depends on the way that the economy starts to collapse as to what type of portfolio. But there's something called the I'm not going to remember the name of it right now, but it's the infinite portfolio or something like that, in which they recommend 25% in each of precious metals, commodities, stocks, and bonds. And with a portfolio like that, it's supposedly meant to maintain its value throughout any type of economic destabilization. I'll try to look up the name of that so I can get that to you so you can take a look at that.
That'd be great. So 25% metals, stocks, bonds, and what was the other one?
And property.
Property, okay.
Okay.
I appreciate that.
Well, thanks very much for calling, and so we're out of time, James. Parting thought, and we'll let you go.
Again, I think that the summer doldrums have hit in some ways, but it's still an interesting time, so I think we'll have to keep our eyes on the markets. But I'm not going to be here on the program next week, and then I think you won't be here the week after that. So people will get a couple of weeks reprieve, and we'll be back in August to keep an eye on what's going on. So I hope people will be checking the markets and ready for our next conversation.
All right, fine. Well, thank you for reminding me. You weren't going to be here next week, and the week after that, I won't be here. So anyway, God bless, and we'll look forward to talking to you the 1st of August. Bye-bye.
All right, take care.